Okay, so I'm the first speaker to talk about galactic black hole systems, galactic stellar mass black holes, I should say. So of course I won't be presenting everything since I have Anne and Rob following me. What I'm going to concentrate on is trying to discuss the light curves of black hole transients. So as it turns out, the black holes for which we have dynamical mass measurements in our galaxies are all transients. It might not be so surprising since such dynamical measurements can only be made when the system is in quiescence, so that you need a transient system. And so these systems are all transients, and what I mean by transient is that they show large amplitude outbursts at all wavelengths, X-rays, which I show here in red, and also in the optical and in the radio band. So Anne will be talking about the X-rays coming from those black holes during the outburst, and I guess Rob will be talking about radio. And what I will be basically talking about is the optical in some sense. So these outbursts can reach the Eddington luminosity. They last for hundreds of days. They have an e-folding timescale of tens of days, and they have recurrence times which are not very well known, but which range from, say, a year to several tens of years, or say maybe even hundreds of years. Now, we have some fairly strong observational evidence that the accretion disk in the systems in which you have a low mass star which is filling its Roche lobe, and you have a stream of matter which is forming a disk around the black hole, then we have strong observational evidence that at least in its outer regions, the accretion disk which forms around the compact object, because matter has to lose some its angular momentum, is at least seen in its outer regions. And in the 1970s, Osaki proposed that a class of systems which are somewhat similar to the black hole transients, which are cataclysmic variables in which you replace the black hole by a white dwarf, and which show also outbursts, but somewhat different from the ones that I'm showing here. He proposed that the outbursts of those dwarf novae are caused by an instability in the disk, and we have fairly strong evidence that it is actually the case that the disk is the site of the eruptions that we see at all wavelengths. So what I will be talking about is the application of this idea that we have some instability in the disk that is causing those eruptions, and apply that to black holes. So if you take the analogy with cataclysmic variables, so you have a thin disk in the outer regions, which goes up to the white dwarf where you might have a boundary layer and emission of UV emission. So if you replace this for a neutron star, white black hole, or mass X-ray binary, then what basically changes is not so much the size of the disk or the conditions in the outer regions, because these systems have comparable orbital periods, somewhat similar. But really what changes is, one, the mass, because obviously a black hole will be more massive than a white dwarf. But also what really changes is that the accretion disk will go to a much, much lower radii, much, much lower radii, presumably in this model up to the surface of the compact object, which is of the order of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 centimeter for a black hole neutron star, compared to 10 to the 9 centimeters, say, for a white dwarf. So basically, you expect that when you're moving a model which will explain the eruptions of dwarf novae and cataclysmic variables and apply it to black hole and neutron star, then basically what will change a lot is will be due to the change in the inner radius of the disk. So the model is the disk instability model. What it basically assumes is that you have a thin Keplerian disk, that the angular momentum transport in this thin Keplerian disk is due to viscosity, which is parametrized by the Shakura-Sanyaev viscosity, where basically nu is proportional to the pressure, as was mentioned yesterday, or in another formulation, by the sound speed times the scale height of the disk, with some parameter alpha, which in the standard model is supposed to be constant. the typical temperatures that you get in this Chakrasaniyev disk range from, say, 1,000 Kelvin to 1,000,000, and the disk is optically thick. Now, the reason that you have an instability is that when you input the opacities in there, then the hydrogen opacity has a very steep dependence on the temperature as it ionizes or recombines. And that actually destabilizes the disk with respect to thermal or density perturbations. So when the hydrogen is fully ionized, you can perturb your disk viscously or thermally, and the disk will stay stable. However, if it happens to be only partially ionized, then basically the disk cannot react to the thermal and density perturbations and has either to switch to a state in which all the hydrogen will be ionized or go back down to a state in which all the hydrogen will be neutral. And typically what this gives when you compute models of a disk at all radii is that you have a critical mass accretion rate from the companion for which at all radii you will have enough viscous dissipation to keep the hydrogen ionized everywhere. On the other hand, if this mass accretion rate from the companion is low enough, then basically you won't have enough viscous dissipation in the outer regions of the disk to keep the hydrogen ionized so that it will be neutral. But as the viscous dissipation increases as you go inwards, then the hydrogen will eventually become ionized. So you have a two-zone disk in which part of it is ionized and part of it is neutral. Obviously, in the middle, the situation will be unstable. And what the disk does is that a heat front develops, and we'll switch the disk to a fully ionized state with a high mass accretion rate, which it cannot sustain in a steady state. And this is the eruption. Most of the mass will be accreted, and you won't have enough viscous dissipation to keep the disk hot. So the disk will switch to a neutral state, and this will be the quiescent state. So basically, what I will be talking about are models of how the disk actually moves from the ionized outburst state to the neutral quiescent state. So this model makes really two predictions. The first prediction, which is sometimes overlooked, is that really, and is in my mind the strongest prediction, is that it really says which systems should be stable and which shouldn't be stable. And this is really independent of the alpha, this parameter that I had in the description of the viscous transport. The other thing that it does is that it describes, presumably, how the accretion rates should evolve through the disk when you are in a transient system, in an unstable system. And this will depend, actually, on the viscous parameter alpha that I inputted. So when you apply it to cataclysmic variables, then, I mean, with the standard disk instability model, you get things which look more or less like what is observed. And this model can be considered as a pretty good model for what happens. But however, when you apply it to black hole and neutron star low mass X-ray binaries, then as I will explain, you get complete failures. The first reason is that this model predicts that all of the systems that we see, low mass X-ray binaries, should be transient. So in this plot, I show the orbital period, which basically gives you an idea of the size of the disk as a function of the mass accretion rate, which we estimate from the companion. And what the disk instability model would predict is this this line here, so which basically says that as your disk grows bigger, you need a higher mass accretion rate from the companion to keep all of the disk ionized. So basically, above this curve, you would expect the systems to be steady, while below this curve, you would expect the systems to be transient. And what I've plotted in green here are the systems which are known to be steady observationally. And clearly, this doesn't fit the data. So what Van Paradijs noted in 1996 is that there is a strong change that has to be made to this model when you, from the observational point of view, and that is that you have to include irradiation heating. So irradiation heating is simply the fact that as you go to lower radii, you can reach higher temperatures. So presumably you have photons with higher temperature that can impact the disk in the outer regions, and help keep the disk in the ionized state. And there are several observational, there is observational evidence for this X-ray heating going on. For instance, take the fact that in neutron stars, when you have a nuclear burst, you first see the X-rays, and then after a lag of several seconds, you see reprocessing in the optical of those X-ray photons in the outer disk. So if you take into account this X-ray heating of the outer regions, this extra heating on top of the viscous dissipation, then basically what you see here is a modification to the critical mass accretion rate above which you would expect the systems to be steady. And this gives you a pretty good, a better idea of what is actually happening in low mass X-ray binaries. So there needs to be a modification there. The problem is that we actually don't know how the high energy photons here actually impact the disk, the outer regions of the disk here. What I actually show is that if you suppose that you have a point source in the center of your disk, and you have some, and the disk, and you take fully into account self-consistently how you expect the height of the disk to vary with radius, then you cannot irradiate those outer regions here because they will be shielded by the hot inner region. So you have to assume something different, probably that there is some corona above the disk for which we have numerous evidence, or actually that the disk is warped in some systems, which can actually bring the disk out of the orbital plane so that he can see a point source in the center. But this is really, this problem was already mentioned in the ITP meeting 3 years ago. And to my knowledge, this is still a very much an open question, what the geometry of irradiation in X-ray binaries really is. So the second problem that I mentioned, so I just said that this problem could be solved if you take into account irradiation heating. The second problem is that when you try to model what the light curves should be of transient black hole and neutron star low mass X-ray binaries, then you don't get what you would expect. What you get is something like this. The first thing that you see in the light curves is that you have a huge number of little reflares, what we call reflares here, that is huge variations during the outburst of the luminosity, which are absolutely, which are not seen in the observations. The second thing that you see is that the outbursts do not last for very long. They last for, say, a few tens of days. They're basically like dwarf novae outbursts. And that the recurrence time between outbursts is less than a year. So for instance, in this calculation by John Canizzo with parameters that correspond to the first system which I, that I showed, the first light curve, A0620, where you basically expect to have a huge outburst every 70 years or so, then basically what you see are a lot of very weak outbursts every 2 years or so, which are which could actually observationally be seen, but which have not been seen. So the basic reason for this is that as soon as you have reached the outburst peak, there is nothing in the standard model that can help keep the disk hot. So you have this high mass accretion rate in the outburst, which will dump mass onto the compact object. And as soon as the outburst peak is reached, then the disk starts cooling. So that means that as soon as you cannot accrete so much mass in the disk so that there are very high densities left in the disk, and that is what explains the reflares, because you only need a little bit of mass at some radius to trigger another outburst. And that actually explains why you have these successions of very weak outbursts at small radius when you reach a small radii, because you only need to bring in a little bit of matter from the outer region inside to trigger a new outburst. The other problem is that the disk extends to very low radii, as I mentioned in the beginning, contrary to cataclysmic variables. So that explains this fact, but it also explains, leads to another problem, and that is that you have a very low mass accretion rate in quiescence. In order for the disk to be fully neutral in quiescence, you need the mass accretion rate through the disk to be extremely low, And actually, what close to the compact object, you would expect the mass accretion rate to be of the order of a few kilograms or a bit more per second. Unfortunately, black hole X-ray transients are observed in quiescence with X-ray luminosities of the order of 10 to the 31 or 32 Hertz per second, and that is not explained by this model. So although this is usually stressed as a major argument against having a thin disk extends all the way to the compact object, there are other arguments based on the morphology of the light curves that also suggest that actually you need modifications, and that these modifications include, first of all, irradiation, and second of all, the truncation or evaporation of the thin disk into something else. So first of all, as I said before, since we expect irradiation to be a major contribution to the heating balance in the outer regions of the disk in steady-state disks, then it is obvious that in the outburst phase, when the mass accretion rate is close to Eddington and the state of the disk is actually close to steady-state, then you would expect this irradiation to be important as well. And since you have extra heating, you will expect that this will help keep the disk hot for longer, and that this will help accrete more mass in the disk so that you will get rid of those high densities which are left over in the disk, and that will help remove the problem of reflares, explain why you have longer recurrence time, because you will need longer to actually reaccumulate the mass that you've lost in an outburst. The second thing is the truncation of the disk. And because irradiation will help remove mass in the disk, but will not remove the problem that if you have a disk extending to a very low radii, a very small amount of matter is still sufficient to trigger an outburst. And what you actually need to do, and that was originally proposed in dwarf novae where similar problems appear, is that you need to truncate your thin disk at some radius so that you don't have those very, very unstable inner regions. So what happens when you include evaporation? And I'll start with this. And this is a calculation by John Canito. And so you start with parameters appropriate for A0620, and you have this series of small weak outbursts, which I showed before. And as he increases the evaporation, or basically he moves outward the radius at which the inner thin disk is truncated, what he sees is that you basically remove all those weak little outbursts here, and you're left over with only major outbursts every 100 years or so. So basically what happens is that when you're in outburst, you have a high mass accretion rate, so your evaporation rate is basically negligible, and the thin disk extends all the way down to the compact object. However, in quiescence, you have a low mass accretion rate, so that the evaporation rate is important, and until up to this radius, the thin disk will be, the thin disk will only extend up to a certain radius. Of course, the flow doesn't stop there. It switches to another state, and as we have seen in the previous days, a likely possibility is that the flow actually becomes relatively inefficient, since those flows exist only for mass accretion rates, which are small. So we would have then a two-phase accretion flow in which we have a thin disk outside and a hot, relatively inefficient flow inside. Now, the nice thing about this model is that since the mass accretion rate here is much higher than the mass accretion rate here in quiescence, where it extends all the way in quiescence, the disk actually leaks. So you put in mass at the outer edge, but you're losing mass inside to this relatively inefficient flow here. So it takes longer to build up mass in the outer thin disk, where you actually will have the outburst. So it takes longer to trigger an outburst, and this is how you explain the fact that you have longer recurrence time and no weak outbursts. Obviously, the problems are that you don't really know what the inner disk evaporates to. And the second thing is you don't really know how the evaporation mechanism works. As for irradiation heating, it is fairly straightforward. So this curve here shows the outburst for a model in which evaporation or truncation of the inner disk is included. but without any irradiation. And what you see is that as soon as you reach the outburst peak, then basically the disk cools and you have a very short outburst. As you increase the radiation efficiency, that is how the X-ray photons, how efficient the mechanism by which X-ray photons actually hit the outer disk, then basically what you see is that you can keep the outburst going on for much longer, and actually much, much longer, hundreds of days, and that at the same time, since you will be accreting more mass, instead of having outburst with recurrence times of every 5 years here in this case, you get recurrence times which are much longer, in this case of the order of 10 or 15 years. So how this works is quite straightforward. Since you keep the disk hot longer because you have this extra heating term, you prevent the formation of a cooling front, and I'll show this in a moment, which means that you have longer outbursts, which also means that you have viscous decays, exponential decays, as had been predicted by King and Richter in 1998. And you have a large fraction of the disk mass which is accreted because you're going at close to Eddington accretion rates for a long, long time. And basically that helps not having to remove the reflex which were due to the high densities in the disk, and this helps get longer recurrence time. But as I mentioned earlier, in the case of steady state disks, of course we don't know what the geometry, the exact geometry is. So now I'm going to focus a little bit more on the model to show you what really happens in the calculations. So this is a sequence of outbursts in a model around a 7 solar mass black hole. And this shows what the accretion rate at the inner radius of the thin disk is. And you can see that it goes up to a little bit less than the Eddington accretion rate. So what happens in outbursts is that the thin disk, which is shown in green here, actually extends all the way down, presumably to the compact object. While when you are in quiescence, that is when the disk is neutral, then basically this radiatively inefficient flow takes over, extending to about 10 to the 10th centimeters. And then the other thing that you can see is that during the outburst, on which I will focus just a little bit later, most of the disk mass is accreted. So in this particular case, it takes something like 20 years to rebuild sufficient mass to trigger an outburst. So this is just to briefly show you how it works when you trigger an outburst. So this is the disk just before just after an outburst was triggered. So this is the surface density here that I'm showing as a function of radius. This is the temperature in the disk as a function of radius. And here I'm showing the light curves. So this is days. This is the V magnitude, and this is the mass accretion rate at the inner edge of the thin disk. So what you see here is a heating front. So the disk here is hot. The hydrogen here is ionized. And this is moving outwards in the thin disk. And at the same time, as the mass accretion rate is increasing, the evaporation rate, thin disk is moving inwards to the surface of the compact object. When you are at the peak of the outburst, the profiles are very close to a steady state disk. So you will have a steady state disk with a very high accretion rate, much higher than what is given by the companion. And at the same time, this high accretion rate gives you X-ray photons, which help keep the disk hot. So basically what you have here is that the disk stays in a series of quasi-steady states, and the density gradually decreases as the disk accretes viscously. And that is what gives you the basically exponential decay. After the temperature at the outer edge becomes smaller than, say, 10,000 K, hydrogen can start to recombine, and you have the formation of a cooling front, which you see here propagating. And the propagation of this cooling front, unlike what happens in dwarf novae, is set by the irradiation temperature. The cooling front cannot move faster than the irradiation temperature is decreasing. And that is really what is helping your disk stay longer in outburst. When you reach quiescence, there is some adjustment between the accretion rate and the exact radius where your thin disk is truncated and replaced by a radiatively inefficient flow. So basically, just as you reach the minimum in the mass accretion rate, your disk temperature is extremely flat, around 2000 K. And then as mass gradually diffuses down, you build to larger and larger temperature until a critical density is reached at which the temperature is enough to ionize hydrogen and you start a new outburst. So if a strong conclusion from these light curves is that if you want the disk instability model to apply to black hole or neutron star transients, then basically what it tells you is that the thin disk has to be truncated somewhere and replaced by something else, a relatively inefficient flow being a most likely possibility. And a question which is not addressed by this model is that it does not predict where the X-rays come from. As I said earlier, the temperatures that you get in a thin accretion disk range from 1000 K to 10 to the 6 K, which is clearly inefficient to explain the radiation that we see at 100 keV, for instance. So for instance, in a quiescent accretion disk, then you would expect that this radiatively inefficient flow is going to be the source of those X-rays. Other possibilities include magnetic field reconnections, for instance, in a corona above the thin disk. And I would like to mention that, in my opinion, studies of the variability of quiescent black hole transients can provide important clues. And for instance, I'm showing work by Rob Hines here on V4 for Cygni, where he sees huge variations in the HR of flux in quiescence on timescales of hours in V4 for Cygni, which is a black hole candidate. For instance, this is work by Zurita and Jorge Casares in on quiescent black hole transients in white light, where you see superposed on the ellipsoidal modulation of the companion star huge variations in the optical flux. The other thing that you see is also in X-rays for the same black hole candidate, V4 for Cygni, this is by Kong et al., where you see variations in the X-rays on the time scale of hours. I should also mention the studies of neutron star transients in quiescence. So the light curves I basically showed you were light curves in which you have a fast rise and an exponential decay, and which are pretty similar to what you see in a lot of transients, like all the systems shown here. But obviously, XTE has been able to get light curves for a lot of other systems, some of which are very, very different from the light curve which I've been showing you. And one might question whether this model here is really the whole story. And I just want to quickly show you. I just want to briefly show you some light curves that you can get with additional physics. And it's not entirely surprising because in Dwarf Novae 2, you see that you need additional physics if you want to explain the observed light curves of the whole range of systems that you observe. So, for instance, you can vary the irradiation strengths. Since we don't know how the irradiation geometry really is, we can imagine that there could be some variation, for instance, because you have this hot accretion flow inside, which has a varying geometry as you go through the outburst. You can imagine that there is a disk wind, for instance, that removes mass when you are in outburst. You can imagine that you have varying mass transfer rates from the companion. As you are in outburst, the secondary is irradiated and responds to this irradiation by shedding more mass. And this is probably what is happening in the long, what are called the long outburst transient, neutron star transients, which have outbursts which last for tens of years, and which cannot be explained only by the disk instability model, probably require additional mass being shed by the companion. Or you could have modulations if the irradiation flux is completely decoupled from what happens to the mass accretion rate in the disk. So to summarize, the disk instability model that applies to dwarf novae gives reasonable timescales and amplitudes when you apply it to black hole transients, and also predicts reasonably well which systems should be transient and which systems should be steady, only if two conditions are met. One, that irradiation heating is taken into account, and two, that the syn disk is truncated in quiescence. Now, the interesting thing is that if you take those two things into account, then you don't need to invoke a dramatically different viscosity from that of dwarf novae. That means that you have two systems which are somewhat different, but which will have the same viscosity. And that, I think, is a pretty important statement, because it was said earlier in the literature that in order to explain the light curves of black hole transients, then you would need a totally different viscosity from what was inferred in dwarf novae. Obviously, the shortcomings are that the irradiation geometry, although we know that there is irradiation, the geometry is unknown. That the evaporation mechanism and what is the outcome of this mechanism in terms of relatively inefficient flows is unknown yet. And the other shortcoming of this model is that it doesn't make any spectral predictions in the X-ray band. And I just want to show some light curves, that one could make. So if you actually combine a spectral model such as one for ADAS with the code that I've just been describing, then you can self-consistently deduce what the accretion rate should be through the ADAF, and what should be the irradiation rate from the ADAF onto the thin disk, and make spectral models that you can compare to observations. Obviously, this is pretty uncertain since we don't really know what is the correct solution that you should use inside. So this is what I want to end up with. Thank you.
I think it's worth pointing out that in the original paper that Hans Ritter and I wrote predicting that when you would get an exponential decay, that we also pointed out that if the disk is very large, you can't irradiate the whole thing.
Yes.
In that case, you won't get a thread. You'll get something like a linear decay.
Yes.
And you won't accrete all the mass in the disk. Yes. You'll leave behind a large fraction.
That's true, yeah.
Now, fortunately, what does turn out to be true is that the longest period transient known actually does have a linear decay, which is the, 1744 minus 28, I think. It's a 10-day binary and has a linear decay. But of course, this thing then recurred very quickly afterwards, within a year or so, with a decay that was neither exponential nor linear. So I think a lot of those very irregular light curves are probably very long period systems, in which case you have to look at the hysteresis effect of repeated outbursts.
I fully agree.
I've heard statements that the magneto rotational instability can operate reasonably well, even down to ionization fraction 10 to the minus 10 or 11. So if it's working, of course, it presumably allows accretion to proceed just fine. In your quiescent case, what is the ionization fraction that we get?
Yeah.
So there are simulations by Jimstone and others resisting non-ideal energy and ionization level of 10 minus 5 is starting to get. It's non-linear, so you cannot use a linear theory and assume the very small energy. Mm-hmm. It's at 10 to minus 5 or below, it's hard to have. And I think you can have a good case now that it might be that the MRI doesn't occur.
So yes, I should add, there's a strong shortcoming. You need a mechanism for the angular momentum transport in the quiescent disk. MRI is not enough. Well, what you learn is that it's coming from the inner regions of the disk and not from the outer regions. I think that might be a problem for magnetic flares, for instance, because if, you know, there are magnetic flares that explain the X-rays in quiescence, there should be no reason why it should be different between dwarf novae and a black hole transient. So that tells you that, you know, the X-rays are really coming from the regions of the flow, I guess. Oh, sorry. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
The question was,
what do we learn from seeing X-rays in quiescent dwarf novae? And what can we apply to the observations of quiescent black hole transits? And my answer was that what you see in quiescent dwarf novae is that the X-rays come from the regions of the flow. I mean, maybe Sergei will want to comment on this, but if I understand, then in his model, the X-rays would come from the outer regions of the flow. And if in quiescent dwarf novae, which are not supposed to be very different from quiescent black hole transits in the outer regions of the disk, then you see that the X-rays come from the inner region and not from the outer region, then you would suspect that the same is happening in black hole transits. And as well mentioned earlier today by Jean-Pierre, we really need a black hole eclipsing system to rule this out.
But this quiescence, you have this evaporation. You need your evaporation process, and part of it will accrete onto the, at least part of it will accrete onto the white dwarf in quiescence. There's an evaporation flow going on quite.
Well, you don't necessarily need it. It depends on the system.
Doesn't that explain the X-rays, or what's wrong with that?
Yes, it's true. So what was your question exactly?
The X-ray, for example, in the models that Myers have made,
yes.
The X-rays in quiescence, I think, comes from the evaporation process, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
So the data suggests that it's extremely small region close to the right,
yeah.
So it's not
there at all. It's kind of optically thin, so all the emission measures will be closer to the surface.
Well, so
remember, the white dwarf, compared to black holes, have magnetic fields. And quite often, when we see an X-ray, probably comes from even a weak magnetic field that can be dynamically important. Right. So, we know that as you mentioned, the X-ray comes from a very small region, smaller than the size of the white dwarf. It certainly comes from the inner region of the magnetic flow. But the analogy, what you see in detail probably cannot be applied to black holes, maybe to neutron stars, depending on the magnetic field.
Have a surface from which X-rays come, right? Now, if you remove it and replace it with a black hole, there is no surface from which X-rays can come. So then, if there are any magnetic flares in the disk, that's the only place that it can come. You know, so I don't think this argument, one can simply take the same argument.
Well, just because white dwarfs have a surface where the X-rays can come from. Well, and
right, black holes don't have a surface, you know, to meet X-rays. So, possible that the only source of X-rays is, you know, this.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that the X-rays are coming from this relatively inefficient flow,
uh-huh.
which has a small radius compared to the size of the outer disk, and so. Yeah, sure. There will not be a perfect solution to this until we find an eclipsing black hole transient, and you know, we can actually see in quiescence whether the X-rays are eclipsed or not. The radio properties?
What are the radio properties?
Well, I'm sure Rob Sander will explain everything.
You may not talk about transits, you may talk about boosts.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So the question was, what are the properties, the radio properties of quiescent transients? And
ratio of radio to X-ray flux in supposed quiescence as the low hard state sources do towards the magnitude higher depletion rate. So I would say that at least in the case of B404, you should consider that this thing is still making a jet. And I don't really know what quiescence means.
I was just wondering if we can learn anything about disk outflows in those systems in terms of producing an outflow using MHD effects, because we can definitely rule out line driving because it's so hot. So do we observe strong disk bipolar outflows in those systems? And if not,
well, that compared to cataclysmic variables, the answer is no. But, you know, not the same kind of outflows. You see you don't see like winds.
That's right. Winds. So is there any explanation based on MHD theory of launching and accelerating winds? Why is that? Why do you don't see winds there? MHD driving is robust, right?
Well, in these systems, I'm not quite sure. I couldn't hear your question very well. In which these systems?
CVs where we suspect line driving to be important.
There are winds from CVs, yes.
Yeah. And we explore possibility that it is being driven by lines.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps
MHD as well. Yeah.
Here, lines should be ruled out because everything is too hot.
Right.
So what happens with your MHD driving if it's important? What do you think? What makes a difference here? Why don't we observe winds here?
Well, do we know that we don't observe winds here?
I think this is what I was speaking
about. Oh, no, I never suggested that.
I
don't know where you got this idea from.
I mean, I don't think we know there aren't winds. I would say it's quite likely that these regions in the low hard states and the central regions would drive outflows, and not all the gas that makes it to the inner part of the thin disk actually makes it down the hole. So I would guess there would be outflows from these.
But this is not based on the observations, right?
No. This is a theoretical prejudice.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure there's any evidence against outflows in these systems. Observational evidence.
You probably do get outflows because there's absolutely no reason for doing this model for a central depletion rate to know that it should not exceed the engine limit. They get awfully close. So I suspect you do get outflows anyway. The luminosity does not exceed Eddington, which is not the same thing as saying it doesn't flow so
fast. But there's no direct way.
It's not very easy to see.
More questions? Okay, thank you all.